Coming up, in addition to talking about the newest novel in his Death in Shanghai series, Garrett Hudson gives a few podcast recommendations. Plus, Justine's book recommendations are by the most highly acclaimed, or at least the biggest selling author she's mentioned to date. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. We're sponsored by ReQueered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. Justine, I did a very stupid thing a few minutes ago.
Oh, dear.
Not like I don't do stupid things all the time.
Yeah, I know, but this must be particularly stupid if you're mentioning it.
It's not that stupid, except the timing was wrong. I just drank a cup of coffee really fast.
In fact, I put ice
in it so I can drink it really fast. And you know what coffee does? It dries me out like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So if I end up sounding like Kathleen Turner, please forgive me.
Okay.
It's the coffee. I have my water next to me. I'll keep guzzling it, but I am parched at this moment.
I see. Okay. Well, at least you're caffeinated.
Yes, I am caffeinated. I am caffeinated. I will be able to stay awake through this segment.
Good.
I don't know if you know who the guest is this episode. It's Garrett Hudson. He's back.
Good. Wonderful.
He's a good author, a nice guy, and he's really knowledgeable on queer history. And so he shares some of his knowledge with us.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's a good conversation. And now before you begin your recommendation, have you noticed I've barely mentioned Paul Rudd in a while?
Yeah, barely. Barely.
Yeah, I may have mentioned his name, but I haven't really talked about him. You usually don't read the show notes, do you? You already know what the show is about.
Well, what I was going to say is I often go back and read the show notes from, like, you know, 6 months ago, so I remember.
Yeah, but you don't generally read them like the week
I out. Generally don't read them as they're coming out, no.
So you don't know that I've been a little sneaky.
No, I don't.
Paul Rudd, as you know, I find him damn sexy. And
yes.
he's also
is this about the links to Paul Rudd that you've been sneaking into the show notes when you think I don't notice?
Yes. Because here's the thing. Paul Rudd is damn...
I would not count on me not reading them.
Okay, well, I didn't think you did. He's a really funny guy, though. The problem with Paul is he needs to fire his agent because he's been in some really shitty movies.
Okay.
Terrible movies. And so he doesn't shine through. So for the past 7 weeks, this is week 7 in a row, there's a link in the show notes to the Paul Rudd video of the week. And
yes.
I'm disappointed you knew it because I wanted it to be a surprise for you.
Yeah, well, I'll just tell you, it certainly was a surprise the first time I saw it.
And you never mentioned it. It's been almost 2 months.
Yeah, well, you know, you didn't see my eyes rolling so hard in my head that they were rattling my brains.
I think only one listener has brought it up to me, and that's because he sent me a picture of Paul Rudd where he looked hot.
Yeah, everybody else is rolling their eyes so much their brains are rattling too. Or they're clicking on it and being very surreptitious that they like him as much as you do.
Well, if you like Paul, go back the past 7 weeks. I think it's Meredith Dench is the very first one I did it. And you can watch some brief YouTube videos when Paul is funny and his real personality gets to shine through.
Okay.
That's my gift to the listeners.
Excellent.
Has nothing to do with books, has nothing to do with crime fiction, but it does have to do with my lust for Paul Rudd.
Okay, you got it. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes. Were you going to say something after that? So?
Yes. So.
Did your mouth completely dry out now?
Yes, it did. I didn't know if I had more to say, but actually, that is pretty much it. I'm done with my little rambling on just something that's near and dear to my heart.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I'm ready to hear what you're going to recommend today.
Well, you know, I'm going to recommend one of the most famous gay history books out there. And that's only because it is known by many, many straight readers also. James Patterson's Instinct. It was originally Murder Games, and then it was made into a TV show called Instinct, and they've now changed the title of that first book to Instinct. And his second book is Killer Instinct. So I read both of them.
I have a question for you. Have you read any other James Patterson's books?
I have, but I don't generally read them as a rule.
The reason I ask is, every book he puts out, he lists, or his publisher lists, under LGBTQ mysteries or thrillers. Is that true, as far as you know?
No, I think these are the only ones.
Oh, well, they're being sneaky. Okay, so tell us about Instinct.
I'll tell you a couple things about it. First, and I'll get my pet peeves out of the way.
Okay.
I don't like books in which the character knows, the narrator knows something that they don't tell the reader. You know, somebody, and this, most of the book is written in first person. And at an end of the chapter, he says, I figured it out. And then we don't know what he's figured out.
And
that first person point of view just drives me crazy. So there's a little bit of that in this book. And also I don't really like when it's written in the first person and then it switches to third person and for things that you see that the first person narrator is not in. So, you know, I can forgive that. He's writing the book afterwards. He knows what happened. So he talks about what I did and then he talks about, you know, what other people did at the time. So that's a little bit less annoying.
I got to tell you, when the protagonist knows something and doesn't share it with the reader, it's unfair, and I generally hate it. The fact that James Patterson is so hugely popular, I would probably still give him a try, but...
Well, the rest of this book is terrific. I mean, really. The downside is that the crimes in both books are, if you saw the TV show, which only ran for one season, much to my disappointment... If you saw the TV show, then you saw the crimes in these two books. But as with anything that's made into a movie, and certainly a shorter thing like a TV show, the book is far richer and far more interesting and better done than a TV show can be. Yep. The other thing that amuses me, and before it was known that he was a gay sleuth, at the beginning of the book, he comes home to his spouse called Tracy. And he just talks about Tracy. Tracy laid my clothes out for me. We had a big, you know, interview coming up. And then the woman from the adoption agency comes and looks at him and says, oh, and then he reveals Tracy is a man and we're a gay couple trying to adopt. So I wonder, you know, he's kind of playing hide the ball, but I wonder how many people picked it up not realizing it, and then got halfway through and went, what? Who? Oh, dear. What am I going to do now?
Scrum.
Well, I just thought that was kind of an interesting trick to play on the reader, and I wonder how much, how many of the readers were surprised by that.
Well, I have picked up books and found that the characters were straight, so turnabout is fair play.
Yes, and especially some of those books that are under LGBT fiction, and you go, wait a minute, the main character is straight?
Yeah, because the guy that runs the hot dog stand or something is gay, so they throw it under LGBTQ.
Exactly, right. Those are all my pet peeves, but now let's get to why I think this book is, you know, it's James Patterson, he's got a co-writer on this, and I assume as he gets older, the co-writers do most of the writing. You know, it's still got his name on it, and it's still mainstream, it's still a bestseller, and it was still made into a TV show. So you can only imagine the quality of this book. The main character is a professor of psychology, and he's an ex-CIA agent. And he's written the most famous book on abnormal psychology. He teaches abnormal psychology, and so much of the books are peppered with the kind of psychological insights that almost seem like they're psychic. And I don't know how realistic that is, but it's a lot of fun in a book. The first book in the series, they bring him into the investigation because the killer sends his book off to the news reporter. First book is about a serial killer, and the serial killer kills someone and then leaves a playing card, which, like a tarot card, you know, you can read it into anything, and then the next, when you get to the next murder, you go, oh, that's who it is, and that's how the previous card was warning us about it. And they never quite catch up to that at that point. So what they do with the serial killer is they never quite catch on with the cards, but they do eventually figure out what all these victims have in common. The second book is a pure spy thriller. There are terrorists. The book starts with bombings in Times Square, and they have to race against the clock before these terrorist cells blow up something else in the city.
Ooh.
And it's after 9/11. It's in New York, and it is filled with Mossad and MI6 and the CIA. There's a joint terrorism task force in New York City, and I think they throw in a few other agencies in there, like the Saudis and Iran, and you know, occasional mention of Guantanamo, a little mention of Bin Laden, how they caught him. And so it doubles as a mystery, but also the mystery is all about these spies and these agencies.
It sounds complicated.
It is sound complicated. One thing I don't always like, and when I beta a book, you know, sometimes the author will in the middle like kind of sum up everything that's gone before, and I say, you're really just like laying it out for yourself, so you can probably cut that scene. I was very grateful in the middle that they did a whole like a chapter where they summed up everything they knew from the previous chapters, because I was really kind of losing the thread of how things fit together, and I needed that reminder in the middle of the book, even though I'd already read it in one sitting. So it, and the whole thing plays out like a movie. I read it once, you know, tips for writing the bestseller novel, and have the scenes play out like you're watching a movie. Don't spend a lot of time dealing with things you can't see on the screen. And this does that. I mean, you've got just enough insight to know what's going on, know how the protagonist thinks, but it just plays out like a movie with one action scene after another. The visuals are wonderful. The streets of New York are great. They go from brownstones to ratty little apartments to the taverns. And it's just every scene you can just picture the setting and all the people, and he just takes you along for the ride. I recommend both of these books, and they both have thrilling recommendations, but the first one also has an intriguing recommendation because it is a very unique serial killer.
Okay, so Instincts has a thrilling and intriguing recommendation, and
yes.
Killer Instinct has a thrilling recommendation.
That's right. That's right.
That's good. I don't think we've done thrillers enough, so I'm glad you did those.
I tend to prefer mysteries, and occasionally I recommend thrillers, but a lot of thrillers are like, here are the bad guys, let's go chasing them, and mm-hmm. they don't always have enough mystery in them. When I run across a thriller that is a mystery also, then I bring it forward for the listeners.
See, I feel that way about, Matt Damon. Who does he play that he's always on the run?
Jason Bourne.
They don't really have stories. I mean, they're exciting and on the edge
yes.
of the seat, but
yes.
they don't really have stories.
Right. Right.
And actually the very first, I was having seizures for a while and they still don't know why, but I had to walk out of one of those movies because my head was spinning. But
yeah,
that's I don't know why I brought that up, just because I like to talk about myself.
Yeah. Well, it's always, you're the star of the show. So they can hear a little bit more about you all the time. Maybe, you know, they have to know more about you than just that you like Paul Rudd.
There is more to me than just liking Paul Rudd. That is
yes.
true.
Mm-hmm.
Someday I'll just list all my qualities off.
Okay.
That's James Patterson. What about Recruit Tales? Do you have anything from there today?
Coming out today, if you haven't pre-ordered it, you need to get there. And it's Nick Hoffman 4, Little Miss Evil by Lev Raphael. It is another murder mystery set at the State University of Michigan, and it's as good as the others. Meg Perry, who writes the Jamie Brody mysteries, it has done the foreword for this one. She's now finished with her Jamie Brody series, and she's moved on to his brother, Kevin Brody, for her newest series.
Well, great. I like Meg and Lev, so that's a great combination.
Yep, so it's out today.
Wonderful. I'm going to move on to Garrett Hudson.
Sounds great.
Hi, this is Brad. Not only do I interview authors, I write novels too. Check out my Mitchell Riley mystery series on my website, bradshreve.com. Garrett Hudson, before we begin with your interview, I'm going to pull a fast one on you.
Oh, no.
You are a LGBT history nut.
Yes.
That's my word. Before we even begin, I want you to pull one piece of little-known LGBTQ history out of the air and tell us about it.
Oh, no. little-known, huh? Okay.
Or elaborate on something we may know.
Okay, I can do that. Clearly, attitudes have varied widely over time, and it's not always been an even progression towards more rights or more acceptance. There's been quite an ebb and flow over the years. And just looking within Western civilization by itself, there was a period there in the 20s and 30s when there was a lot more acceptance than there was in subsequently the 40s through the 60s, including and perhaps most especially in Germany in the 20s. They had very large and very active and visible gay communities and potentially trans communities as well. A lot of cross-dressing performers and whatnot in Germany in the 20s. And all that went away in the blink of an eye. And even in the U.S. and other Western countries, it really declined in the 40s and kind of hit bottom in the 50s and 60s for a while. So it's not always been an even, you know, progression through time.
That German history, anybody that's seen the play or the movie Cabaret, mm-hmm. that really shouldn't surprise them that much, because it's, for the most part, what that was all about to a very large degree. And what I'm finding interesting, I made it no secret, I'm currently doing a lot of research on a novel I'm going to write that takes place during the 20s. And I'm really surprised to learn basically what you're saying, that there has been an ebb and flow. And things were almost at their worst here in the United States in the 40s and then especially in the 50s.
Right. Yeah. And McCarthy was part of that, but he was also as much a symptom as anything. The culture was turning against things a lot, and McCarthy just kind of took advantage of that.
Exactly. I would agree. He definitely wasn't the cause. He just happened to come in right at the right time when America was ripe for something like that, which we tend to do from time to time. People step in and at the right moment, don't they?
Yeah.
Let people know who you are. Garrett Hudson writes upmarket mysteries and historical spy fiction driven by characters who are moving and unforgettable. He lives in Indianapolis with his husband, 4 adorable dogs, 2 oddball cats, and more fish than you can count. You can usually find him reading about history and daydreaming about being there. This is where his stories are born, and he hopes they transport you the way his imagination transports him. And I'm going to go straight to there. When you say reading about history and daydreaming about being there, where do you most daydream that you would want to be if it was somewhere else in history, somewhere and someplace else?
Oh, boy. If it's just strictly daydreaming, because, you know, things weren't always so great in, you know, the good old days weren't always so good.
Oh, yeah.
But definitely, I think the 20s in New York would have been a really fun place to be. You know, if you ignored the fact that you could get arrested just for drinking, or they didn't have the medical care that we have now, I think it was a really fun atmosphere. I would have had a good time, I think.
I think I agree with you. At least off the top of my head, I certainly agree with you. So, No Accidental Death is your most recent novel. That is the third in the Death of Shanghai series, and it just came out last week. For those of us that aren't familiar with the series, discuss the Death in Shanghai series, and including who Doug Bainbridge is, the series in general.
Sure. It's a series of mysteries that take place in Shanghai in the 1930s. The first book takes place in 1935. And Doug Bainbridge is with the Office of Naval Intelligence, a young officer, and he has a background in being very fluent in two Chinese languages. And so he's selected by the Office of Naval Intelligence to go on an immersion in Shanghai to really learn in-depth Chinese culture and civilization and be an asset in that way. So he's sent there for a two-year immersion, and he has a tendency to get himself caught up in murders. Shanghai is a very big city. There's a lot of corruption. The head of the Chinese government's anti-opium board was the biggest opium driver in the entire country, and he lived in Shanghai, and he could basically use his official position to get rid of his enemies. And it was just a really interesting place and time. There was a very diverse international community there. Several countries had what they called extraterritorial rights, which meant that their citizens were tried under their own country's systems. Like, they had their own courts in China. There was an American court in China, a British court in China, etc. And so a lot of Western countries and Japanese nationals as well had significant privileges in Shanghai. But then the positive side of that was that there was this very really diverse community there, and a lot of jazz, a lot of nightlife. It was just a really interesting place, and I thought, I can set murder mysteries there. And so I did.
And it definitely is a really colorful time period, and it certainly shows mm-hmm. in your novels. What was the defining moment when you said, this is when I have to write my next book? This is the place it has to be, the place and time. When was that?
You know, it was a little bit of serendipity. I just kind of stumbled across some things going down a rabbit hole on the internet, and I came across a news article about the revival of some of the old jazz clubs in the old section of Shanghai. And I just kind of, you know, clicked from one link to another and read all kinds of things, and it just all kind of came together. And I thought, wow, this would really be a great place for a murder mystery.
So we skipped over Doug Bainbridge, the protagonist in the story. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Doug.
Okay. Doug is a young naval officer. He kind of got into the Navy by accident, having graduated from college right at the depths of the Depression, having just really ticked off his father so that his father didn't hire him in the family business, and he had to find another job really fast. And with his Chinese language skills, he was kind of in demand, had been offered something with the Navy, and so he kind of just got into that by accident. And then kind of got sent to Shanghai by accident. And when he's there, he's a little bit of a fish out of water at first, but he runs into an old friend from San Francisco, and they go out one night to a club called the Jade Dragon. And his friend, who is a reporter, goes out at intermission and never comes back. And Doug goes out to look for him and finds him killed in an alley. And the police don't do very much. They assume it's a robbery that just went wrong. And he knows there's more to it than that because of the conversation they had in the Jade Dragon Club before Tim went out. And so he takes it upon himself to investigate the murder and find out who killed Tim.
Now, in the first book, Tim's friend is Art Jones, another reporter, mm-hmm. who does become Doug's friend as well and is in this novel. Tell us about Jonesy.
Jonesy's one of my favorite characters, honestly. He's very gruff, very matter-of-fact, down-to-earth, but he's really a softie on the inside. He's got this very gruff exterior, and part of that is because of, you know, having come up, growing up as a closeted gay kid in a small Michigan town, he put up that kind of an exterior. And then his early years as a reporter were working the labor beat in Detroit at a really dark time for the labor movement. And he saw a lot of really violent strike breaking and things that were, he had editors that didn't allow him to print things that he had seen and whatnot. So he kind of puts up this gruff exterior, but he's really a softie on the inside. And he's got a bit of a thing for Doug. And Doug's not always very comfortable with that, and I have a lot of fun playing with that.
Well, and I want to get into that a little bit, and I want to talk about Lucy, but you made me think of something that I read that you had said once. And this is regarding what you just said about Jonesy. I heard you once say that in your book, queer characters are acknowledged and seen. And what you said is, I try to make this natural. It's not an agenda. It's just what I know.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah.
I love that, by the way. So, but go.
Thank you. Yeah, just like a lot of gay men, most of my social circle is other gay folk. So it's just really natural for me to always have gay characters, and usually multiple of them, because I can't imagine life without a lot of gay people around. And so that just kind of comes out in what I write. And I do think it's important to have that representation, that these characters don't just happen to be gay, but that this is actually part of who they are and part of how the character relates to the world. And so I try to bring that out.
And then the third person that we have that is most prominent in the series is Lucy, Doug's girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Can you care to tell us about her and their relationship?
Yeah, Lucy was an accidental character. She was really, when I very first sat down to write The Jade Dragon, the first book in the series, it was NaNoWriMo, which is in November National Novel Writing Month, for those who are not familiar with it. It's an annual challenge to do 50,000 words of fiction in 1 month, and it's difficult, but I love it, and I do it every year. And so I had sat down to write this during NaNoWriMo, and on the first day, in the first scene, she just kind of showed up as this little throwaway character, somebody to have a conversation with Doug and kind of set the scene. And she kept coming back, and she kept coming back, and she kept coming back. And I really liked her. She's this very intelligent, very sophisticated, very modern girl. She drinks, she smokes, she swears. It's all the things that aggravate her mother. And she's just a really fun character, and she is a good counterbalance for Doug, too, because Doug, especially early in the series, can be a little bit uptight about things, and she calls him on it all the time. And I have a lot of fun with that as well.
And the reason I wanted to get the three of them out of the way, for lack of a better word, wanted to bring them up in the beginning, is 2 years has passed since The Jade Dragon. How mm-hmm. has the story progressed and their relationships changed over that two-year period? How much time has passed since the books have actually been published?
The first book, now I got to think. The Jade Dragon's been out for 4 years. And Assassin's Hood, book two, was out 2 years ago, and then this one just came out.
Okay, so not that significant of a difference. But 2 years has passed.
2 years has passed, yeah.
So how have they and their lives changed?
They have grown quite a circle of friends, which especially comes out in book two, Assassin's Hood. Found family is a really important theme in my writing, and it really comes out in this series even more than some of my other things. Doug has a very strained relationship with his own family. And like I said, Lucy likes to, you know, aggravate her mother, who still lives back in the States, by the way. So the friends that they develop become like a surrogate family to them, and they're all very close, and they have a lot of fun together, and they're very different personalities too. I try to make everyone unique. But that's probably the biggest way that they've developed over the 2 years, is they've really developed this close circle of people who support them. They've also gotten very accustomed to life in Shanghai and can't imagine living anywhere else. So in this book, this takes place during the Japanese invasion, and Lucy wouldn't ever leave. She actually refuses to leave, even when some of their friends do leave the city because of all the fighting taking place in the northern parts of the city. And part of that is just because they've gotten so rooted there.
It's interesting that you mentioned found family. And I found it's kind of stereotyping, but when it comes to LGBTQ folk in general, and especially authors, found family seems to be a pretty big deal.
Yes. Yes, it really is for a lot of us. And I think that's because for quite a few queer folk, our own biological families weren't always the most nurturing places for us. A lot of people had very difficult relations, or sometimes they don't even have any relationship with their birth families anymore at all. So their friends really have filled in that void. And even if, you know, we still, like, for example, I still have decent relationships with my family, but not always perfect either. And my friends still provide me support in ways that my family can't, because they just don't understand.
But I think a lot of people don't get that. It's not just that they don't want to understand. It's hard for them to understand.
Mm-hmm. They don't have the point of references that we do. They can't experience the things that we experience. And you know, telling them only goes so far. You know, if they can't actually live it themselves, they don't really internalize these things. And that's, I think, where having your close circle of friends who go through the same thing you do really is very important.
Yeah, people will frequently say after they come out, well, I'm the same person. And you know what? I accepted that people had to have time to adjust, because you know what? In their eyes, I wasn't the same person, at least not on a surface level. I had an entirely different future than what people had anticipated. And I think people forget that sometimes.
Yeah. I think there's a difficulty sometimes letting go of the image they had of you, which was never real to begin with, but it was real to them. And they have trouble with that sometimes.
People hate labels, but they exist and they always will.
And they always will, yeah.
That is for sure. So let's go back to Art Jones, Jonesy. Mm-hmm. Gay man in the 30s in Shanghai. You talked about it was kind of an exciting time period. What was it like for someone that was gay during that time and period in that era?
Well, it wouldn't have been easy. Even in places that had community and where people were a little bit more open, nobody was really out. There was no such thing really as being out of the closet. You didn't necessarily hide it, but you were what they would say discreet. You just didn't talk about things very much. Now Jonesy's kind of fun because he will talk about it to Doug because Doug knows and Lucy and several of their other friends know. But because Doug knows and is also just a little bit uncomfortable with it still, Jonesy likes to talk about it a lot just to kind of get his goat.
Yeah, my husband and I like to call it the Paul Lynn factor.
Yes.
Even though Paul denied it all the time, it, for the most part, it was just like, yeah, that's Paul, but we just don't discuss it.
We just don't discuss it. No, it's true. And Shanghai was, it was a big city. And of course, there are always going to be more gay people in big cities than in small towns just because there are more people. Plus, Shanghai was a port city as well. And you tend to get everything in port cities. So I think it's at least marginally easier for the characters to have been gay there because of the environment than it would have been back in Jonesy's small hometown in Michigan.
That's an interesting fact about port cities. That's why San Francisco is as colorful as it is. Mm-hmm. And actually was a drop-off point for those that were outed in the Navy as well, which happens in a lot of port cities. So,
yes,
they do tend to be colorful places.
Yes, they do.
So other than the 20s and Shanghai, in the future, if you're writing another historical series, which I presume there will be another one down the road.
Oh, yes.
What do you see as other possibilities, as eras and locations that call to you?
Boy, I really love ancient history a lot. Now, I don't know how much of a market there is for fiction set in the very deep past, but I really love, and by ancient, I don't just mean like ancient Greeks and Romans. I mean like way back, Bronze Age and stuff like that. Like I'm really fascinated with periods of time where we don't necessarily know exactly what happened. We have clues and there are theories, but it was so long ago that there aren't that many records. So talking like 3,000 years or more ago, I love that time period. And I think there could be all kinds of possibility to write fiction for that period. I just don't know if I ever will or not. Or if I do, it may just be for me.
We bring up an interesting ethics question because we don't have a lot of information from that time period. If you did decide to write fictional stories, you might have to fill in some blanks there on your own.
Yes.
Ethically, how important would it be for you to make it for the reader to understand that you are filling in blanks, that this isn't necessarily based on true historical fact because there just isn't enough evidence?
Yeah, I do believe in full disclosure. I put a historical note at the end of all of my novels saying what is a true fact and what I've elaborated on. But I can usually do that in a page or two. So, you know, my novels all take place in the 20th century so far. If I were doing anything much more ancient like that, I'd probably have to have a pretty extensive historical note with lots of disclaimers at the end. I do feel like I need to warn readers if I take too many liberties.
And one of your early favorites was one of my early favorites is James Michener,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't surprise me in the least when I read that. I think it was on your website.
It is, yeah.
Not everybody's familiar with James Michener. Actually, I'm surprised when I bring him up and I get a glazed look on people's faces. And maybe it's because he's not been around for a while.
No.
For our listeners, tell us who he is and how he influenced you and what his style was.
He wrote epic historical sagas, often multi-generational. many of them are doorstoppers, 800 to 1,000 pages. So they're not for the faint of heart. And he would get into very great detail of historical things and situations. Like, he loved to write about a particular place through centuries and generations. And they're really fascinating stories. He was, I think, one of the most popular historical novelists in the mid-20th century, 50s through 70s, I think.
And anybody who has not read a Michener novel, I'm going to clue you in on a little secret here. He doesn't just write centuries. Sometimes he writes millennial. I think an example, well, actually, probably one of his most famous, Centennial, which mainly takes place around Colorado, Wyoming area.
Yes.
And he starts basically from the beginning of time and how the land developed and the world developed and yep. that sort of thing. And I find when I read his novels now, I find that interesting. I will say at one point, I didn't find any of that interesting. So I'm going to suggest to the listeners that go out and read some James Michener novels. There's some great ones. Chesapeake is one of my favorites. Alaska is a good one.
Yes.
But if you get in there and it's and he's really going in depth into the formation of the rocks and that sort of thing, do what I did and skip ahead to when people show up.
Yeah.
Because there were several times I just threw his novels aside and said, I don't get it. And then I started skipping ahead and I would read not even when the earliest people would come in, but when the actual stories would start taking place, because mm-hmm. he can really get into depth there. And once he got into those, man, he just locked you in. And he did a beautiful job of intertwining fictional characters with historical events to the point that sometimes it was hard to tell where one began and one ended.
Yeah, I agree. Another example, you brought up Centennial, but he did the same thing in Hawaii. He had like a whole chapter on the ancient volcanoes and the formation of the islands out of the ocean. And yeah, modern readers now wouldn't be interested in that. And I think I remember when I was a teenager just kind of really skimming that section.
Yeah, and see, I can go back now and read that, and it's interesting. But back when I was younger, I just couldn't get into it at all. And Hawaii drives me crazy. If you've seen the movie Hawaii, don't base the book on the movie.
No.
It's a fine movie, but it's a musical, and I don't see how it relates to that novel in any way, shape, or form. But they do say it's a novel based on the James Michener novel Hawaii.
Yeah, loosely.
Oh, I could go on all day about that. But so it's kind of obvious, but can you say how he has influenced you? And do you see possibly in the future doing as he did and intertwining more real historical characters with your fictional characters?
I probably won't. I loved reading that when I was a teenager. And Michener wasn't the only one that did this. I think especially in the late 20th century, it was really common to have your protagonist bumping into real historical figures. Like every chapter, there was this new historical figure. Mm-hmm. And that was really popular for a while. I don't see myself actually doing that for a couple of reasons. It's not super realistic that, you know, your random protagonist runs into famous people left and right all the time, because most of us don't run into famous people left and right all the time. Maybe one, if we're lucky, or two. But also, in addition to it not really being realistic, I don't like to take a whole ton of liberties with real people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try really hard not to have real people appear as characters in the book. Now they'll come up in conversations because, you know, just like, you know, you and your friends might have a conversation about Joe Biden, and somebody in my books will have a conversation about FDR. So these people do come up, but they're not appearing as characters in the story. And that's largely my discomfort with trying to make, like, I would not feel comfortable making FDR a person in my story because I don't really know what he was like. I mean, I can read about him, but I don't really know what he was like. And this was a real person, and he has real descendants living now, and I couldn't do him justice, I don't think.
And it's also a lot of work.
It would be a lot of work, yeah.
It's one thing to enjoy history. It's one to have to really dig in there like crazy like that. But I agree with you. I think there is an ethical issue there. You know, I write contemporary Los Angeles, and for instance, I use real characters in my novel. For example, in my most recent novel, it's mentioned that Sally Field introduced two of the main characters at an Oscar party. But that's all. I don't get into a personality. I don't get
right
because, one, there's a legality issue. that legality issue goes away after they've been dead and gone for a while, but I still think there is an ethical issue.
I agree with you. And I think the way you did it was very realistic. Of course, they're in LA. You know, they could run into a famous person at an Oscar party. Yeah, you did that very realistically, I thought.
Yeah, it's just quick and easy. And I feel like that's the safest thing to do. Good on you. I think you're doing it the right way.
Oh, thank you.
Staying with your earliest influences, in the fourth and fifth grades, you won ribbons in young authors contests. Do you see that as the time when you said, wow, this writing thing may be pretty cool, or was it even before then?
It was really then. I'd always been making up stories before then, but I think that was the first time I got any validation for it. You know, I could entertain my cousins telling stories or something like that, but actually getting some validation from a teacher was really empowering. And that's when I thought, you know, I could actually be an author someday when I grow up. So yeah, that is kind of when that started.
And you said, I want to be an author someday when I grow up, and you are in the corporate world working in human resources.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Oh, that was a roundabout way as well. I was a French major in college, and there's not a whole lot of jobs for French majors. So I kind of worked in customer service for a while, and I got a customer service position working at a retirement plan company, and that kind of got me into the employee benefits field. And from the employee benefits field, I just kind of gradually morphed into HR. And so that's where I've been for a while.
Given that, how are you able to balance your writing career with your full-time career?
Well, it's not always easy, especially we have very busy periods, especially in the fall when there's open enrollment for benefits and whatnot. But I try to always make sure that I keep work within work hours. I'm not one of those people who's constantly checking my work email at 11 o'clock at night or anything like that. I don't do that. I even now working from home with, you know, COVID and everything like that, I still keep pretty standard office hours. And so when I'm not in those office hours, I don't work at my day job. And that allows me time in the evening to be able to do some writing or, you know, revising or whatever stage I might be in at that point. Research as well. Yeah.
Do you find after a long day or before your day begins, do you have to, even though you may love being a writer, do you have to really force yourself to sit down and do it?
Sometimes, yeah. And I definitely don't do it right after work. Right after work is when I will go up, be with the dogs for a while, clean the kitchen, listen to some podcasts, just kind of let my brain settle a little bit. And then later in the evening, then before we have dinner, is when I'll do my writing.
So you brought up podcasts. I'm curious, out of curiosity, what podcasts that you can suggest to people?
Oh, sure. If you're interested in LGBTQ fiction, the Rote podcast is excellent with that. There's also the Big Gay Fiction podcast. So it's a little bit more romance focused. And so I don't listen to that one all the time, but I do listen to that one some. And they're very fun. I enjoy listening to them. If you're a writer, I listen to a lot of podcasts about writing. There's Writer's Inc., The Creative Pen, The Sellmore Book Show. There's a lot of good ones out there.
You mentioned LGBT-related Rote podcast and the Gay Fiction podcast, which the guys that host both of those shows are great. They were all really helpful to get me up and running, and we've all promoted each other. I would say this show and those shows are all pretty good of a balance of mostly being towards the reader, but giving enough that the writers can get a little bit in there as well.
I could see that. Yeah, definitely.
Will and Jeff from the Big Gay Fiction podcast, I actually met about a year before I began this podcast at the LA Times Book Festival.
Okay.
I think that's what it's called. It's been a couple of years since we've had one now, but LA Times Book Fair. Very nice couple of guys. It was great to meet them. And I'm glad I did, because it gave me a launching off point when I decided to do a podcast. I could easily reach out and say, okay, guys, tell me what I'm doing here, because I don't have a clue.
And that doesn't surprise me that they'd be really nice in person. They have a very, there's a lot of warmth that comes through in their podcast, I think. And I could see that they'd be like that in real life.
It's very natural. It is very real. And I would say that is true of Vance and Baz over at Rote Podcast as well.
Okay.
It is hard to fake it.
Yeah, I could see that.
I'm a total asshole. So hopefully I fake it pretty well.
Yeah, you fake it really well then.
Or maybe I'm not. Maybe I come across as a total asshole. I don't know. So So we talked earlier about your characters. Let's get into your novels are character driven.
Mm-hmm.
And in the intro, it says that your novels are upmarket novels.
Yes.
And part of that is that they are of a genre fiction, yet very literary. I hope I'm saying that.
Yeah. And I think part of what makes something upmarket as well is that it is at least as much about the characters and their story as it is about whatever the tropes are of the genre. So I try to write a story that is about some people and their story as well as being a mystery. And I think it's, if you try to do that in equal measure, you're going to have an upmarket mystery.
You may have heard over the past several weeks, I've mentioned several authors that I think do a really good job of it, that if it wasn't a mystery novel, I would still enjoy reading the story because I like the characters so much. And
yeah.
When an author does that to me, I always wish I could drive to wherever they are and give them a big hug.
Mm-hmm. So good. I think of
you're about 1,500 miles away from me, but hugs across the miles.
Thanks. I think of Ann Aptacker and her Cantor Gold Mysteries. Cantor's just this really incredible character that I just love, and I love her stories so much because of Cantor, as well as the noir mysteries that she finds herself in. And I think the Hazard and Somerset Mysteries, Gregory Ashe's series, I think it's the same way too. You love those characters, and yet you also kind of want to shake them a little bit too. But I think that's the key. An upmarket story just pulls you into the lives of those characters. And I think that really, makes it a little bit more memorable than just a mystery. The mystery's fun, but then there you've got the characters as well.
I think in today's world, that's very important in general. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I really wonder if Agatha Christie today could make it. Because Miss Marple wasn't all that interesting.
She was a busybody.
She was pretty caricature. There wasn't mm-hmm. a whole lot of depth to her. I think we knew she had a nephew. I think he was in there for a little bit and mm-hmm. some other things, but there really wasn't a whole lot there.
And Hercule Poirot was, he could be amusing, but he was also insufferable, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't really in real life want to spend very much time with him.
Well, but sometimes it's fun to, trying to think of look, the guys on Breaking Bad, they weren't very likable.
Well, that's true. I love that series too. They did a great job with those characters. Yeah.
Yeah. But they wouldn't be guys you want to hang out with.
No, that is, you make an excellent point. Yeah.
So back to your characters, you write in the third person point of view.
I do.
Is that true in all of your novels?
Yeah. I have tried first person before, and I just don't really have a knack for that. So I stick to third person close whenever I can. I will occasionally do a zoom out scene, but for the most part, I try to be in a close POV, but told third person. And for my Shanghai Mysteries, the first two books are told almost entirely from Doug's POV. In No Accidental Death, though, this third one, I get a little bit more into Lucy's point of view and a little bit into Jonesy's point of view as well. And some of that was the structure of the mystery itself. With Doug being back kind of active duty on the Navy, there were times when he, like, I almost needed him to be two places at once and like, he couldn't be. And so having Lucy and Jonesy as established characters gave me a little bit of an out there. And it was really kind of fun. It allowed me to explore them in a completely different way by telling a scene through their vision. And I really loved doing that, and I hope it comes across well. I liked it.
Well, I was going to ask, when you caught yourself doing that, was it exciting? Did you say, oh, I'm doing this? And was it exciting at that moment?
It was exciting, yeah. Especially for Jonesy, I was a little bit more nervous about doing scenes through Lucy's point of view with her being a woman and, mm-hmm. and me obviously not being. But my critique group is mostly women. There's eight of us total, and there's five women. So my critique partners are two men and five women. And they gave me some pretty good feedback. So I felt comfortable at the end with it, but I was a little nervous at first. But with Jonesy, I just had fun with him.
Critique groups are great that way to
yes.
kind of toss it out and say, what do you think here? And we're like, no, women don't think that way. But
exactly.
That's good you had them. Do you ever anticipate writing first person? You said it's not your thing. Are you the type of writer that likes to give yourself a challenge?
I do, yeah. And I might try that again sometime. I don't have any plans to in the near term, but I do like to challenge myself and try different formats sometimes. So yeah, I might do that at some point in the future and just see how it goes. I can always rewrite it if I need to.
Yeah. Because I'm the opposite. I feel much more comfortable with first person. And okay. Third person is, for whatever reason, very uncomfortable for me. I have a thriller that's halfway written that I stopped years ago, and I actually think it's pretty good, so someday I'll get back to it. It is third person, and what's interesting is I didn't even think about it. It just, when I was writing it, it's just the way it happened. And I think if I had stopped and thought about it, and there must have been some point in my head that I said, okay, I'm going to write it in this fashion, but I don't recall that event taking place. I think it just, I sat down and I started writing, and it's just the way it happened. And I think in a thriller, that's usually, you kind of want to know everything that's going on anyway. And you write spy novels, even though they're mysteries. So you kind of want to know more of a God point of view.
Yeah, there are advantages and disadvantages to both. And I've read lots of novels from each style and have enjoyed novels in first person and third person. And yeah, so I would definitely give it a shot again. I just don't know that I'm going to do it real soon.
In 2012, you attended the Midwest Writers Workshop, and it had a major impact on you. And yes, you have gone almost every year since then, as well as you've attended Writer's Digest conferences. Mm-hmm. For somebody like myself who actually has not attended a major conference, what is it you gain from them?
Oh, so much. You learn a lot, obviously, about writing craft and revisions and things like that from the sessions you go to. But I think the biggest advantage is just the friends you make and the connections you make. Some of my best writer friends are people I've met at Midwest Writers Workshop, and we go back every year, and it's like a reunion. We all get to see each other again. It's very happy. It's kind of funny. I'm an introvert, like not even borderline. I am an introvert, but when I get to a writer's conference, I become very extroverted because it's, you know, unlike a lot of large gatherings, a big gathering of writers is very energizing to me. And I just love the energy of a writer's conference. And there's a camaraderie that you don't seem to get anywhere else. And it was really hard last year. There was, you know, with COVID, nothing was in person. Everything was virtual. And this year, there seems to be a mix of that. Unfortunately, Midwest was, it was virtual again this year. And I just didn't see myself sitting at my computer for three straight days at virtual sessions. So I did skip it this year, but I am hopeful, knock on wood, that we can all be in person again next year.
Yeah, I've attended a few conferences this year. A couple were podcasting conferences, and it's not even close.
Yeah.
Not even close. And an interesting thing when you're talking about the energy at a writer's conference, and of course, I'm stereotyping here, not all writers are introverts. I can tell you I've learned that from doing this show.
That's true.
But stereotypes do exist for a reason. And most writers I know are introverts. And it's interesting when you get a group of introverts together that feel comfortable being introverted together. They aren't introverts anymore.
It is funny how that works, isn't it? Very unexpected.
Yeah, it really is. The synergy gets going, and it's great that it feels so natural. So this is your eighth novel.
It
is. Are we going to get another one in the series?
Yes. So I'm actually in the research phase right now for book four, and I'm planning to write it during November this year for NaNoWriMo. So hopefully I can have everything all done within about a year to a year and a half with revisions and everything afterwards. But I'm looking forward to diving into it again. At least a fourth novel. There may be a fifth one. I'm a little bit leery of having an amateur constantly solving mysteries. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to end up Jessica Fletcher, you know, but there will be at least four and probably five.
But you know what? I think that's okay. When people read amateur mysteries, they know it's absurd.
Oh, sure.
And it's part of the fun. I mean, we all make fun of the fact that Jessica Fletcher stepped over a body every other day. And
right.
And thank God, you know, she wasn't your friend.
Exactly.
I used to kind of snub my nose at amateur mysteries. And now I find I have a lot more love. I think because there are several series that I've read that I just like the character so much that I didn't care that they were an amateur. Jessica, I didn't make fun of because I wasn't really a big fan of the show. I thought it was pretty cheesy. It was the 80s Love Boat or the 90s Love Boat, whenever. What was it, the 90s?
It was the 80s. Yeah.
80s. Okay.
I remember it.
But anyway, I'm probably just infuriated a huge number of people by saying I wasn't a fan of Jessica Fletcher.
My parents always watched it, so I remember it being on, but especially the later seasons of when I was starting to get up into high school age and stuff, I was not interested anymore.
Well, she really changed it up when she took it away from Cabot Cove and moved it to New York City.
This is true.
That was her doing. She had to convince the producers to do that. That was part of her agreeing to do it. And I don't know why I went off, why I remember that, considering I'm a person that rarely ever watched the show. I sometimes get very involved into the background of shows. Like, well, my mom and I were Bewitched fans. But I can tell you behind the scenes, like, everything about Bewitched. I can tell you about the house, the studios, the sets, the characters. I guess it's part of being a writer. Because actually, and I'm curious, maybe you did this. As a kid, I think my earliest writings were rewriting TV series that I watched. Because most of my life revolved around television.
I did a lot of Star Wars fan fiction and Battlestar Galactica fan fiction when I was about 8 or 9 years old. Yeah. And some things that were just plainly ripoffs, but you know, you don't know any better when you're 9 years old. You just, you know what you like and you write it.
A lot of people get started in fan fiction. Mm-hmm. I have never told a single soul this in my life before. I wrote Gilligan's Island as a dramedy.
Oh, wow.
Much different show.
I can imagine.
And that was kind of before dramedies were a thing. But it was a much better show the way I had written it. But anyway, it wouldn't be as iconic as it is today. We'll just say that for sure. So we have reached the time for awkward questions, authors again.
I knew we'd get here.
Yes, you did. I'm sure you've been anticipating it.
And yes.
You know the rule. I spin the wheel, and we just see what question you get.
All right. Let's go.
So here we go. Okay. I don't think this one's come up before, and I like it. Why do straight people bother you?
Oh, the world has too many straight people. No. No, it's so funny. Straight people don't bother me, of course, as long as they behave themselves. I like well-behaved children, I like well-behaved dogs, and I like well-behaved straight people.
As long as they don't flaunt their straightness in public.
That's a good one. I haven't heard that one either.
Oh, you haven't?
I don't think so.
It's so repulsive when that happens.
Now, in fiction, of course, I like everybody to be badly behaved. So I guess badly behaved straight people are welcome in fiction.
Badly behaved people are so much more fun to write.
Absolutely. I love it.
Are there things that come out in your characters that are things that you can't say or do? Maybe it's not, as you're writing it, it may not be in the front of your mind, but later when you look back and you say, wow.
Yeah, that happens a lot. And I don't know as things that I can't say or do now so much as it's maybe things you don't think to say or do so much. And it especially when you get into a flow state, things come out and exactly like you said, you read through it later and you're like, oh, wow, that, okay. Wow. I didn't know that was there. It can be very enlightening. And of course, there's always a piece of us in every character we write. You know, you can't ever point to one character and say, yes, that character is me, that character is you. It doesn't really work that way, but there's always some of us in all of them. It just works that way.
Yeah. And sometimes when you're writing a character and they say or do something, it actually can be really profound. It won't be profound to the reader because it just is. But
right.
Like, I'll look at that and I'll think, wow. I think I do think that way, or I never realized I thought that way, or just like you just said.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one of the fun things of writing.
I agree. Yep.
It's one of the great joys. Like you said with Lucy, that she was going to be a minor character, and she kind of just took a life of her own. When you feel that happening as a writer, describe that.
Oh, you know, it can be aggravating right at first because it's not going according to the plan you set for it, but it almost always works out better that way. And when you go back and you read through it afterwards, you realize that your brain knew something that it didn't know it knew, and it your subconscious knew better than you did. And sometimes you just have to go with that. Like, and with Lucy as a classic example there, she wasn't meant to be there, but I am so glad she was. She ended up being one of the best characters, and I love writing her now. I could not have planned that.
And that's awesome. So it has been great to have you back, Garrett.
It's been good to be here.
70 episodes ago that you were on. You were on episode number 30-something, and this is episode number 98.
Wow, it's going by, isn't it? It doesn't feel like it's been that long.
It's been almost 2 years since this show began.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you came back.
Me too.
It's been a pleasure to have you on. And remind everybody, the novel is No Accidental Death. It is the third in the Death of Shanghai series. And it is available now, as of last week. So go out and get it. Either click online or call your local independent bookstore. I presume they can get a paperback through an independent bookstore?
Yes, they can. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Good on you. If you want a paperback, that's the way to do it. I'm going to suggest it. But if you're going to forget it and want to get the book, just go ahead and get it now. Thank you again, Garrett.
Well, thank you, Brad. I appreciate it.